Welcome to the Green Shoots podcast by Appleyard Lees, a conversation for those who own, manage or protect intellectual property.
Hi, I'm Kate Hickinson, a patent attorney at Appleyard Lees. I'm here today with my colleague Edward Rainsford, another patent attorney, to discuss recent cases at the Unified Patent Court now that we're a year in. How are you today, Ed?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Kate, and looking forward to discussing some of these cases.
So I think our discussion today will probably be most interesting to fellow patent attorneys and IP lawyers who are interested in technical and legal aspects of the UPC and the Unified Patent. So this time last year, we were spending a lot of time talking about the Unitary Patent and the Unified Patent Court, the UPC. We were also desperately filing opt-outs before the UPC opened its doors on the 1st of June. So as it's nearly the 1 year anniversary of the opening of the UPC, we thought it was a good time to review where we are at and what decisions have been taken by the UPC in that time. So we both work in the life sciences sector. I'm a chemist and Ed, you're more in the biotech field. In my experience, not many of my clients have been requesting unitary patents. Have you found the same, Ed?
Yeah, I think that's been my experience as well. I think most companies opted out and are still remaining to validate individually rather than use a unitary patent. But we have had some clients that do use a unitary patent. I think it can come down to some different factors, such as the size of the company and whether or not having a sort of protection over the most of Europe is actually useful. If the interest is mainly in the UK and Germany, then it just doesn't make sense to pay the extra costs for the further protection in the rest of Europe. So I think mainly the traditional method of validation is the one that people are still using mostly. But there has been some interest from some of our clients.
Yes, I've filed a few requests for unitary patents, but not as many as I thought I might have done in the last year. So the EPO actually gives data on the number of unitary patents requested, which it's quite interesting to look at and see the progress. The uptake, so that's the percentage of requests received with regard to granting European patents for unitary patents in 2023, apparently was 17.5%, and in 2024, it's 23.6%. So it's increasing. I think that's still fairly low, but I'm sure over the next few years, the number of unitary patents requested will increase. It seems as though, not unsurprisingly, people are probably quite nervous of using a new system and maybe would like to see some established case law and consistency from the courts before they feel more able to use the UPC.
I think that's probably true. I think most people are sort of scoping it out a little bit at the moment and waiting to see when some of the decisions with regard to infringement and revocation come through, what the sort of consistency between the judgments is. And also, I think people were very cautious at the beginning, but now are maybe just more interested as time goes on and it's become something that people just understand a little bit better.
So we're going to discuss some of the UPC cases that have been heard in the last year. So we also have some statistics on the number of cases that have been filed at the UPC. And I'll just run through some of them. So infringement proceedings, there have been 119 cases, revocation actions, 26, applications for provisional measures, 21, and counterclaims for revocation, 156. So obviously, the number of counterclaims for revocation is higher than the number of infringement proceedings. And we had a chat, didn't we, about why we thought this was. And we think it's probably because there's multiple patents being asserted in the same action. Do you agree, Ed?
Yeah, I think so. If you look at some of the actions, there are multiple patents that are being asserted, and that probably is the reason why there's a higher counterclaim for revocation than there is actually infringement actions that have been started. I think that's probably the likeliest of reasons.
Yeah. And then in terms of appeals, there have been 26. And one thing that's quite interesting is that the cases seem to relate to a mix of different subject matters. I think perhaps before the UPC went live, people felt that the pharmaceutical industry, for instance, might not use it at the beginning because of the high value of their patents and the uncertainty. But that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems as though there are a mix of different technical areas that are using the UPC.
Yes, and I was talking to a colleague who more works in the computer implemented invention field, and they thought that there might be a lack of that represented at the UPC and that kind of electronics work. But it does actually seem there is a reasonable mixture of different technical fields, which I think is a good thing because it means we're going to get case law across quite a wide range of different technical fields rather than, say, there either not being any pharmaceutical cases or all of the case law being pharmaceutical cases because maybe they want to launch test cases to sort of scope out the court, which was, I think, one idea of what might happen because the UPC is obviously going to be very important going forwards for pharmaceutical patents in general. So it is, I think, a really good thing that we've got quite a diversity of different technical fields that have cases going through the UPC at the moment.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So shall we move on to talk about some of the specific cases that we've identified that we think are interesting? So the first case that we're going to talk about is Merrill Italy versus Edward Life Sciences. And this is a case that was heard at the Paris Central Division and a decision was issued in November 2023. So it's quite a recent case and there were two issues really that were heard or discussed in this case. So, Ed, would you like to give a bit more detail?
Sure. So, Edwards Life Sciences, which is a US-based company, actually filed an infringement action at the Munich local division against Merrill Life Sciences, which was an Indian-based company, and its German subsidiary, Merrill GmbH. And that case remains pending at the Munich local division. Subsequent to that action being started by Edwards Life Sciences, a subsidiary of Merrill Italy filed a revocation action before the Paris Central Division against the same patent, which was the subject for the infringement proceedings that are still pending at the Munich Local Division. And Edwards Life Sciences objected to this and said that actually under the UPC agreement, the Paris Central Division wasn't competent to hear the revocation action and that the revocation action should have been started at the Munich Local Division. And this goes to the heart of Article 33.4 of the Agreement of the Unified Patent Court, which effectively says that actions for revocation should be brought before the Central Division unless there's already an infringement action for the same parties relating to the same pattern, which has been brought to the local or regional division. So Edwards Life Sciences is basically arguing that Merrill India and Merrill Germany are the same party as Merrill Italy, which means that the action for revocation against this patent, where there's already this infringement proceeding going on at the Munich Local Division, should be heard at the Munich Local Division because of the requirements of Article 33.4. So the heart of the case really is Merrill Italy the same party as Merrill India / Germany?
I think it's interesting that Merrill Italy brought the revocation action separately rather than counterclaiming in the infringement action. I wonder if they think that they might get a decision from one court that's more favourable to them overall.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to determine whether or not, say, the Paris Central Division or the Munich Local Division is going to be more patentee friendly or more opponent friendly, because it, you know, we don't know enough about the way these courts are going to decide cases. So Edwards Life Sciences' issue was actually not that the Paris Central Division may not be friendly to their position, but that this might give Merrill Italy the chance to have two bites of the cherry, as it were, and have a revocation action at the Paris Central Division for Merrill Italy, and then Merrill India and Merrill Germany launch a counterclaim for revocation at the Munich local division at the same time. So Merrill as a global entity is going to have two options to shoot down Edward Life Sciences' patent by having two revocation actions running at the same time in different UPC divisions. And they thought that this was an abuse against UPC procedure and meant that the UPC was sort of being usurped to allow Merrill to knock out their patent potentially in two different attacks.
So I suppose it came down to what the term the same parties means. Is there anything to help with that in the agreement?
So there's nothing really in the UPC agreement that sets out what same parties means, but Articles 46 and 47 do define what parties in general means, and it's what you may expect in terms of any natural or legal persons or a body equivalent to a legal person. So a party is either a natural person or a company. In this case, there wasn't really anything more within the UPC agreement that sort of defines what is meant between the same parties. And what Edward Life Sciences tried to assert was that case law from the Court of Justice of the European Union should be applied in this case, specifically some of the competition law case law, which helps at least their case, they would argue, because it defines parent companies and subsidiaries as economic units, as one entity.
So what can you tell us about the competition case law that Edward Life Sciences referred to?
So they argued that Article 33.4 should be interpreted broadly, and they referred to a judgment which was CJEU case C351 of 96, which is Draught Assurance versus Consolidated Metallurgical Industries and others, which related to the Brussels Convention to try and define what the same parties meant. And the UPC didn't actually like this approach because that they said that that case actually was for a different legal issue and was more about national judges, which national judges have jurisdiction of a case if there's different actions filed in different countries relating to the same parties. So it was just to prevent mutually exclusive judgments, which wouldn't happen in the UPC, they argued, because there's no jurisdictional issue and the UPC agreement envisaged parallel proceedings. So they didn't really accept that argument. And they also, Edwards Life Sciences tried to argue that Merrill Italy was actually not a real subsidiary, but a straw company. And they argued that it was fully owned by Merrill India. The directors work for Merrill India, doesn't have an office in Italy, and the registered address is actually an accountancy firm, and that it was registered in March 2023. So Edwards Life Sciences asserted that basically Merrill Italy was set up in order to create this abuse of the UPC system, as they would argue, to attack the patent in Central Division, while Merrill India was able to counter claim for revocation at the Munich Local Division. So as far as they were concerned, Merrill Italy wasn't a real subsidiary and it's not actually something that's doing business in Italy. And on this point, the UPC disagreed and they said that it had only been set up recently, so the fact that it doesn't have an office in Italy is reasonable, and that the preparations were being potentially made to start an office and form a sort of proper going concern in Italy, and that there wasn't actually any evidence that Edwards Life Sciences could put forward that this was actually just a straw man company and not a real company. So in conclusion, the UPC determined that the definition of a single economic unit with regard to the competition law was really just focused on the fact that parent companies couldn't get away with illicit conduct by their subsidiaries and that there was joint liability. But it was focused particularly on illegalities of subsidiaries as it relates to the wider parent company, and that even in that case law, it doesn't preclude the two companies being separate legal entities. It's just that there's responsibility of a parent company for the actions of its subsidiary. So it was a different legal point, and they couldn't accept Edward Life Sciences' assertion that that applied to this instance. So the Central Division concluded that they were competent to hear the case, and that the UPC framework didn't exclude that the patent could be attacked from different subjects, even if they're linked, and that this wasn't a abuse of the UPC framework. As a final point, the Paris Central Division stated that the UPC framework did not exclude that patents may be attacked by different subjects, even if they're linked on an organizational level or in a commercial relationship, and that even if they were linked in such a way and had the same grounds of invalidity, that the UPC could run parallel actions at the same time, and that this was in no way an abuse of the UPC framework, which I think is an interesting conclusion to come to, and potentially opens the door for quite a useful tactic going forwards if you are challenged by a third party for infringement.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether these two cases do just run in parallel. Do you think that's what will happen now?
Well, it might depend on whether or not there's an appeal to the Court of Appeal. At the moment, Merrill India and Merrill Germany haven't actually counterclaimed for revocation in the infringement suit running at the Munich Local Division. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not they do run a counterclaim action in the Munich Local Division, and when they choose to start that action. Will they wait for a potential appeal here? Will they wait for an indication as to what the Paris Central Division believes to be the issues? It's interesting to see how it would develop.
Yeah, in terms of getting some idea of how patent friendly the different courts are, it would be quite interesting to see a revocation action before the court in Munich and the one in Paris, but we'll see.
It'll also, I think, be quite interesting to see maybe what happens with Merrill Italy over the next year or two when these actions are running. If in the revocation action is being heard at the Paris Central Division, and in that may take a year, it may take 2 years, so we don't necessarily know how fast it's going to be. But if Merrill Italy still remains a company with no office in Italy and not actually trading in Italy, will the argument that it's a straw man company set up to abuse the system hold more weight if nothing has actually changed in that time? It will be interesting to see what happens there.
Well, we'll be following that case with interest, I think. So the next case we were going to talk about is Ocado Innovation Limited versus a member of the public. So I think we're going to call him Mr. X, aren't we? Because his name or her name has been redacted in the decision, and we don't know who this person is. So this is a case that was heard by the Court of Appeal, who have ruled that a member of the public, Mr. X, can have access to evidence and pleadings in a case that was settled. That case was Ocado versus AutoStore. So would you like to give us a bit more detail on this one, please, Ed?
The Ocado AutoStore dispute actually revolved around packing robots. There was a handling device for lifting and stacking containers by robotic vehicles. That was dispute was brought by Ocado against AutoStore in June 2023, asserting their patent rights. However, actually, the two parties settled and the action was withdrawn. However, evidence and action proceedings were filed at the UPC. And while it was still pending, a member of the public requested that they have access to the documents that have been filed by the parties. And that request was filed on the 15th of August, 2023. So Ocado appealed against the decision of the Court of First Instance, which was the Nordic and Baltic Regional Division. So the Court of First Instance agreed that the member of the public could have access to the documents, and Ocado appealed this. So the UPC Court of Appeal issued its decision on the 10th of April of this year, and they assessed the evidence as to why Ocado felt that the member of the public shouldn't have access to the documents of the proceedings.
Yeah, so the decision actually relates to two different points of law, doesn't it? So first point of law is about the composition of the Court of Appeal, and secondly, the right of the member of the public to access the documents. I do wonder if Mr. X or Mrs. X in this case is a very interested patent attorney or patent lawyer that's just wanting to test the law on this.
Quite possibly, because the issue the member of the public had was that the Court of Appeal composed itself of only three legal judges. And there's Article 9.1 of the UPC agreement says that any panel of the Court of Appeal shall be composed of five judges. There'll be three legally qualified judges and two technically qualified judges. The technically qualified judges shall be assigned to the panel. So by having a composition of only three legally qualified judges, this member of the public said that it went against Article 9.1 of the UPC agreement, and that he was not getting a fair trial, and that this was contrary to Article 6 of the European Convention of Human Rights. So UPC stated that they disagreed with this assessment, and that there are instances in the UPC agreement where the Court of Appeal can be composed of different composition. So, for example, Article 9.2 of the UPC agreement says that the Court of Appeal will be composed of three legally qualified judges for matters relating to EPO handling of administration of granting of unitary patents. And they also referred to some other specific sections of the UPC agreement where there were different compositions of the Court of Appeal for different reasons. And in their view of the Court of Appeal in this case, they said that Article 9.1 shouldn't be read in a restrictive way, and that there was actually no technical issue with this case. It was just a legal issue, so they didn't need the technically qualified judges. And they also said that the wording of Article 9.1 says that the technical judges should be assigned to the panel, and that the panel was the legally qualified judges. And if the legally qualified judges didn't need the technically qualified judges, then they should be allowed to proceed without them.
That does seem to make sense in this case, that there wasn't actually a requirement for a technical judge, was there?
Absolutely. There doesn't really seem to be a reason why the technical judges would be needed. And I think it's eminently sensible that they don't, you know, have to appoint these judges whose time is very valuable to this case, which is about legal issues. I do think that the way that the UPC agreement is worded, though, does seem like it gives specific reasons where you don't need technical judges and you can compose it different for particular issues. And the Article 9.1, though, says that, to my reading personally, that the any panel of the Court of Appeal should be composed of five judges. And the UPCA goes on to state specific exclusions to that. But I think potentially that this article wasn't worded in the best way it could have been, and that actually they haven't allowed themselves much leeway with the way that it's been worded. But the Court of Appeal has sort of taken the common sense approach to say, you know, where we don't need them, we're not going to appoint the technical judges. So I think it does make sense from a common sense standpoint, but maybe Article 9.1 could have been worded in a slightly less restrictive way, which may have been slightly more helpful for the Court of Appeal in this case. On the issue of access to the evidence to a member of the public, Ocado argued that access should only be allowed in cases where there's been a decision, because the point of accessing the documents and pleadings is to give a better understanding of the decision. Where there's been no decision, there's no reason to provide access. And they had a further argument that the final settlement was confidential, and therefore the settled case as a whole was confidential. So the member of the public argued that the only reason not to provide access were on the grounds of confidential information and personal data. And that provided a reasoned request was submitted by a member of the public, then the default position should be that they should be allowed to have access. And the UPC Court of Appeal agreed with this and stated that there did, however, need to be a balance between confidentiality and personal data, as well as whether or not the request was abusive and free access to documents to members of the public. And in this instance, they said that the fact that there was a settlement at the end didn't really matter because the settlement may be confidential, but that wasn't what was being requested and that wasn't what was going to be handed over. It was the submissions by the parties and not the confidential settlement. So that didn't really hold any water. And they also said that the member of the public request for access to the statement of claims was of a general nature, and that Ocado hadn't argued or shown that that was abusive in any way. So in the end, they felt that the member of the public should have access to these documents.
So I wonder if this decision will lead to quite an open approach to access to the documents by the members of the public. Although in this case, it has taken over 7 months, I think it was, for the member of the public to see those documents. So it might be good if in the future it happens a bit more quickly.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think maybe in future parties may object less to this kind of request, given how the Court of Appeal in this instance has sort of set out the judgment, and know that they may not win. But, you know, it has taken some time, but the member of the public has now given access to the documents. And I think it is quite interesting that the Court of Appeal did say that there does need to be a distinction made between people who have a general interest and people maybe who have a direct legitimate interest, in terms of that they may also be infringers and potentially wanting to access documents for a particular case for that reason, rather than maybe for a general reason. I think the Court of Appeal did say that the weighting had to be such that it was generally to be in favour of granting access to written pleadings and evidence rather than restricting it, even where there's probably a direct interest. But they also did say that they may have to impose certain conditions with regards to keeping what was given to the member of the public confidential while proceedings are ongoing.
So the last two cases that we've discussed relate more to procedural issues, which isn't really surprising when we're talking about a new court and people are trying to get used to how it's going to function. But as patent attorneys, of course, we're interested in patentability and how the courts are going to look at that, particularly in relation to novelty and inventive step. So have there been any interesting cases so far in relation to patentability, Ed?
Yes, so I think the most interesting case with regards to patentability is 10x Genomics versus NanoString Technologies. 10x Genomics requested provisional measures, preliminary injunction at the Munich local division, and alleged direct and indirect infringement of their unitary patent by NanoString. The patent itself relates to multiplex imaging analysis of a plurality of analytes in cell and tissue samples. The court had to decide on the balance of probabilities whether or not it was more likely than not that the patent was infringed, and also that the patent was valid. So in the patent claims itself, you have your multiple analytes and you have a set of probes which are added in order to image many different analytes in a single sample, because tissue samples and cell samples are quite precious and you may not be able to have enough of a sample to perform repeated experiments looking at different analytes in different assays. So they said that NanoString infringed this patent with their CosMx assays and kits that they were selling, and they therefore requested a preliminary injunction to prevent them from using these and offering them to the public. NanoString countered that the patent itself was not valid in light of several prior art, but the key one was one called, referred to as D6, which was Jenny Goranchon et al. And it basically related to a very similar process, but actually it was done on DNA that had been isolated from blood cells, amplified using rolling circle PCR, and then fixed to slides. They argued that the claim says that it's a cell or tissue sample, but DNA had come from cells, and therefore that was sufficient enough to fall within the limitation in the claim that it was a cell or tissue sample. 10x Genomics also said that the claim required a set of probes to be hybridized to the analytes and to be permanently fixed to the analytes throughout the detection and decoding procedure. And that in D6, actually what was happening was that the probes were washed off and re-annealed, re-hybridized through successive rounds of this detection and decoding. So the Munich local division sided with 10x Genomics on this, and they said that isolated DNA and then amplified DNA could not be considered as a cell or tissue sample. So there was a difference between D6 and the patent. The patent was novel over D6. And they also said that it was likely that the patent should be restricted in the way that 10x Genomics stated, and that the probes should be bound to the analytes and not removed, as was the case in D6. So the Munich local division said that D6 wasn't a realistic starting point as the closest prior art, and that the skilled person in the art wouldn't turn to this when they were trying to solve the problem of a in situ multiplexing array. And they also said that, you know, there was no reason why the skilled person would have a motivation to try and use an in vitro method from D6 and actually use it for cell and tissue samples. So they believed that the balance of probabilities was that the patent was valid and that they issued the preliminary injunction. NanoString then appealed to the Court of Appeal to try and overturn the preliminary injunction. And again, the court said that it has to be more probable than not that the patent was valid over the claimed prior art. Again, 10x argued that you couldn't transfer the in vitro methodology of D6 to the in situ cell and tissue samples of the patent, and that also that D6 doesn't disclose that the probes remain attached to the analyte, and that this was a key part of the claim itself. And NanoString argued the opposite, as they did at the Court of First Instance. The Court of Appeal, however, came to the very different conclusion than the Court of First Instance and said that it was predominantly probable that the patent wasn't valid in light of D6. They didn't see that there was a reason why the skilled person wouldn't try and have a reasonable expectation of success of transferring the in vitro method in situ. And also they agreed with NanoString that the claim couldn't be limited in the way that 10x Genomics had suggested, and that the probes were attached and not removed during the decoding process as you go through the method. So they found that there was an issue with the validity, and therefore the preliminary injunction was overturned. And I think one of the interesting points of this is that the Court of First Instance did use pretty much the EPO problem and solution approach. They talked about the closest prior art. They talked about why it was, could be or could not be the closest prior art based on being the same or similar technical field, minimal modification, structural modifications, etc. So they very much, I felt, followed the problem and solution approach when trying to assess whether or not the patent was inventive over D6 and a combination of other documents that were raised at the same time. Whereas the Court of Appeal didn't follow the problem solution approach. They didn't refer to the closest prior art. They perhaps approached it from a slightly different perspective, maybe of German national law, which referred to what problem was from the patent, but didn't follow the EPO approach to this.
It's really interesting, and I think it's cases like this that we need really to understand how the courts are going to consider issues such as novelty and inventive step. And perhaps more cases along these lines will give people that understanding of the UPC and and maybe lead to people feeling more comfortable using it and to greater usage?
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how particularly inventive step is assessed and whether or not, as is the case here, to my mind, that inventive step has been approached differently by the Court of First Instance and the Court of Appeal. The UPC agreement sets out there's a primacy of EU law, and then there's Article 24.1, which sort of sets out the sources of law which is applicable to the UPC agreement. And these are listed as union law, and then the UPC agreement, then the EPC, then other international agreements applicable to patents binding on all contracting member states, and then national law. And certain commentators have said that this is a hierarchical list, but it would appear, to my mind at least, that the Court of Appeal was more approaching inventive step perhaps from a German national law perspective, whereas the Court of First Instance was approaching it from the EPO perspective, which might indicate that this isn't a hierarchical list, but maybe a list with equal weight, which may be used depending on the situation which certain courts find most applicable. It also certainly shows that the Court of Appeal isn't afraid to go against the findings and decisions of the Court of First Instance, and certainly isn't going to be a rubber stamping exercise, which I think is quite interesting as well.
Thanks, Ed. That was a really interesting discussion today, and I appreciate you spending the time with me on the podcast. I'm sure as time progresses, there'll be lots more interesting cases from the UPC for us to discuss.
Thanks very much. Good to discuss it with you today, Kate.
Thanks for listening to the Green Shoots podcast by Appleyard Leeds. If you have a question or issue you would like our IP specialist to discuss on the podcast, then tweet us at Appleyard Leeds or email us at ip@appleyardleeds.com.